Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For this segment, let's set the stage first. It's 1852, and many Irish starving and struggling have fed the Great Famine and are taking up residence in very crowded, difficult-to-live-in tenements in cities along the East Coast, including tens of thousands here in Boston. That year, the Catholic newspaper The Boston Pilot reports that Irish revolutionary Thomas Francis Marr has escaped from a penal colony on Tasmania and is sailing toward the United States. They declare him the potential savior of the country's Irish immigrants. Less than 10 years later, 1861, Marr is at the First Battle of Bull Run, leading a Union brigade of Irish soldiers under a green flag with a Gaelic battle cry. Now, that fascinating story and how Thomas Marr got to the Civil War is told in Timothy Egan's new book, The Immortal Irishman, the Irish revolutionary who became an American hero. Egan is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for The New York Times, and he joins us today from Washington. Timothy Egan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
I was
hoping for a little Irish music in the intro there.
You might get some on the way out.
We'll see what we can do.
But it's such a delight to speak with you. I've been in huge admiration of your writing for many, many years. So let's dive into this story of Thomas Marr, a man I'd never even heard of. First of all, remind us briefly what landed him in a Tasmanian penal colony.
Well, he was a rebel. And he was a rebel at the time of the famine, the worst crime in Ireland. 1 million people died in 4 years' time. 1 million people starved to death, barely 30, 40 miles from the richest empire on earth, that being the British mm-hmm. Empire. And Marr and his compatriots thought it was actually a crime because they were exporting food in this time of hunger. The potato crop was the ostensible cause of it, but they were exporting grain, beef, barley, pork, all these foodstuffs. And they felt that the British were essentially letting them starve. So it radicalized them. They led a failed uprising in 1848. They were all young men. They were brilliant, included some women as well. And his sentence was to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit.
Huh. You know, now, of course, memory of the Irish famine runs very deep here in Boston. There are memorials to those who suffered and died right in the middle of the city. But before we get to Thomas Marr's arrival in the United States, I was so interested to see that he didn't necessarily begin as a revolutionary or a firebrand that wanted to pick up arms against the British, right? I mean, you write him as being a comfortable sort of poet type. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, he was sort of like a young Hugh Grant. He came from wealth, one of the richest families in Waterford, which is the oldest city in Waterford. His family had gone to Newfoundland and made money. They were still Catholic. They came back, and he went to this fabulous secondary school in England, and he came home, and some people thought he was sort of foppish, and he could have had this gilded life ahead of him, following his father, marrying the prettiest girl in the port, going to on holiday in the South, but that wasn't his path. The one thing that was clear early on, even before Marr got radicalized by the famine, and the famine is what changed him, was that the guy could talk. And he's just real gift of gab. It's often a cliche about the Irish, but this man was extraordinary. And from here to the very end of his life, he could hold people spellbound. I mean, they say he was the most brilliant conversationalist of his age.
Yeah, and which really came in handy later on when he was recruiting Irish immigrants to fight in the Civil War. Now, when he escapes from Tasmania, and as we talked about a little earlier, he sails to the United States. When he arrives here, what's the impact of his arrival?
We've never had anything like the situation in America in 1852. It was the peak of Irish immigration, and the famine had been so devastating. I mentioned earlier 1 million died, but 1.5 million at the very least went to the United States, and these were largely rural people. Many of them were illiterate. Many of them had never been more than 20 miles from their tiny little villages. Many of them had never been on a ship, and suddenly they get on these coffin ships, they sail across the Atlantic, and they wash ashore in Boston, New York, Baltimore, and Philadelphia. And Boston itself has the second largest population of Irish in America. New York is the only one that's bigger. And they rarely go more than a few blocks from where their ship lands. They crowd into these awful, horrible tenements. Some of them have bring their pigs over, and the pigs, as the New York Times said, the pigs slept with the paddies, which was a way of just describing the squalor they lived in. And Marr sees the squalor, and he says, I mean, surely there's some greater thing for these Irish. They didn't flee green valleys for this tenement squalor.
Yeah. Well, so then how, though, I mean, as the nation, as the United States itself is marching towards civil war, how did Marr begin to see what his role could be in the Civil War?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And Marr starts out as an agnostic on slavery. He's not for it or against it, but he says it's legal. We might as well keep it as it is. And Marr had briefly crossed paths with Frederick Douglass, the ex-slave and orator, who came to Ireland in time of the famine. And he said it was amazing how the people weren't racist. That he said, I find myself treated as a man and not treated as a color. Mm-hmm. But that same Douglass noted that when the Irish came to America, they started to pick up a different attitude. So the great fear was that they would not fight for the Union cause because they thought 4 million freed blacks would take their terrible jobs.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because, I mean, we're talking about the eventual formation of a Union brigade with Irishmen, but obviously that wasn't, as you just said, there was no reason to presume that that would happen.
Exactly. Now, let me just back up to one of the reactions to this huge surge of immigration, which we later saw all the other waves, Italians, Jews, Asians, come from all over the world. But the Irish are the first big movement of people from one part of the world to another, to the United States. And there was a huge pushback. There was a party called the Know-Nothing Party. A lot of people have forgotten about it. But by 1854, they had elected 11 members of Congress from your state of Massachusetts. They'd swept the Bay State Legislature. They'd captured nearly half of New York's delegation. And their entire campaign was premised on anti-Irish, anti-immigrant sentiment. They wanted to deprive these people of citizenship. So that was the background. That was Marr's other fight just before the Civil War, was to fight the Know-Nothing Party, which thought these people were alien and could never assimilate in the United States. So interestingly, when the Civil War comes along, Marr sees it as a chance to break Know-Nothing sentiment by a blood sacrifice which would make these Irish fully American.
Oh, interesting. Now, I'm looking at a little gem. There's so many of them in the book, but one that really caught my eye because it's a quotation from the Boston Pilot, the Catholic newspaper that we talked about, that I mentioned in the introduction. And the Pilot's view of what the role of Boston Catholics or Irish should be in the coming cataclysm that would be the Civil War was really interesting, because you quote them as saying, "We will not move an inch when you command us to march to a fratricidal war." Mm-hmm. So when Thomas Marr is, given a commission, how does he convince him? He does it in New York and he comes up to Boston. How does he convince his fellow Irish immigrants to take up arms in defense of the nation?
I'm really glad you read that quote, because that shows what he was up against. This is the same paper that had hailed him as a savior of the Irish masses who've washed ashore in America. And Marr has a two-pronged campaign pitch. He does go and make several speeches in Boston. They're, like most of his speeches, they're just people waiting in the street to hear him talk for an hour. And he has a two-point thing. One is, he says, this country took us in. This country gave us refuge. How could we do anything but defend it? And if they want to know whether we're Americans or not, we'll show them in battle itself. Now, the second pitch is more interesting. Well, it's equally interesting. He then says, once we're done with the slaveholders in the South, we'll take these seasoned soldiers and artilleries and our rifles and everything else. We'll sail across the Atlantic and we'll liberate our homeland from English rule, which has, been the curse of the Irish for 700 years by that time. And so it's a pitch of one part sort of sacrifice for becoming American and one part, let's liberate our homeland.
Ah, interesting. Now, so he forms this brigade, the 69th, right?
It's formed out of the 69th.
Out of the 69th.
A New York militia that's famous. Don't get in trouble with the 69th. They're known as the Fighting 69th. They're still active. they fought in the Gulf War. But it was an all-Irish militia that then, and let me give credit to Abraham Lincoln. Brilliantly, Lincoln names Marr, who's a Democrat, Lincoln's a Republican, as a general of this newly formed Irish Brigade that starts with the 69th, but they recruit heavily out of Massachusetts, Maine, all of New England, up and down the eastern seaboard, until eventually well, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it's eventually known as one of the best fighting units in the war.
Well, let's talk about the losses that they took, because, you know, I mentioned that the first battle of Bull Run, but also, I mean, in the bloodiest battle of the Civil War in Antietam, they took huge losses.
Yeah, it was just brutal. Antietam was the bloodiest single day in American history. We had 23,000 casualties in that one day. And for the Irish, it was horrible. But then they fought in Gettysburg, and they fought at all the battles. But the worst for them was the Battle of Fredericksburg. Marr took 1,200 Irishmen. They told them to put a little sprig of green under their caps before they went up this hill, this exposed hill. The top was a rock wall, and a whole line of Confederates led by Robert E. Lee. And he said, when they find our bodies, they'll know we died as Irishmen, because they had this little green in their caps. And there were so many bodies. He took 1,200 men up on that. They made 12 charges. And at the end of the day, only 280 were still alive.
Wow.
That's something, by the way, that John F. Kennedy mentioned when he gave the Irish Brigade flag to the Irish people in 1963. He mentioned that sacrifice at Fredericksburg.
Well, in the book, you also talk about how Robert E. Lee himself remarked on the valor of these Irish soldiers.
Yeah, and again, I'm glad you set the context. There was a debate whether the Irish could ever fight. First of all, whether they'd fight for the Union or whether they could fight at all, because they were so insulted by the majority class. People said they couldn't organize a parade without getting in fisticuffs, let alone fight a major war. But in fact, only two other brigades in the entire history of the Civil War took more casualties than the Irish did. And the Confederates were afraid of them. They said that was the one thing we really feared, was when we saw that green flag.
Never were men so brave, he said, apparently. Their brilliant and hopeless assaults upon our lines excited the hearty applause of my officers and soldiers.
Yes, and hearty applause is not something that Marr felt, having lost so many. He personally recruited all these people. He knew their mothers. He knew their wives. He knew their family names. He knew what counties they were from. It just crushed him to have these losses.
So ultimately, what happened to Thomas Marr?
So he does, you know, prove, I mean, the effort to fight the Civil War, the great battles they went through, does make them accepted by the majority. They become legendary. Courier and Ives does these pictures of them. There's front page stories all over the United States about the Irish Brigade win again when others had retreated. So he does sort of accomplish this goal, and Marr becomes very, he incorporates the freeing of the slaves as the reason why the Irish died. They would never go back to Ireland and liberate their homeland. But he gives a number of speeches where he says, we did liberate this homeland, that we did free slaves in this place.
It's an amazing story, and I'm so, so happy that you've brought it to light in this new way. The book is The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. It's by Timothy Egan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Megan. Thank you.
We've got more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. And that's it for today. And Timothy Egan, you got your Irish music there.
Thank you. Otherwise, I would hold it against you, because we Irish keep our grudges.
And for centuries at that, I wouldn't want to risk it.
Don't mess with us.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.